Hello, welcome once again to Searching for American Gods, a podcast on the television show American Gods on Starz, based on Neil Gaiman's novel entitled American Gods. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan. I mean, actually, with me in the state of New York.
Here we go again. This is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine. How are you, Phil?
Good. Yeah, I screwed up again because that's usually the beginning of Dark Discussions, which is another podcast that we do, which includes three other co-hosts, including Eric from Michigan, where we talk weekly on a subject, usually a movie that is a genre-related film that we basically review and critique. So, Mike, before we get into tonight's episode of Searching for American Gods, any updates that you wanted to bring up? I know you're going to be heading to Scares That Care, and I also know that you also do another blog and so forth.
Well, my blog is Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com, which I'm finally hoping to update now that school's over with, and a little bit about ScareCon weekend and my thoughts on Death House, and what was the other name of the film?
Dangerous People.
Dangerous People. And then Scares the Care weekend is coming up at the end of July. I'll be down there July 21st, 22nd, 23rd. In 2 days, in fact, we'll be having a drawing for some free tickets to Scares the Care weekend for the people who bought a Dark Discussions t-shirt as part of the Scares the Care fundraiser. And I'll be doing a couple of panels down there. It's in Williamsburg, Virginia. And then, of course, in I don't know, what is it, 2 weeks? We're going to be doing the return of Game of Thrones?
Yes, that podcast, yep.
Okay, and that's You Know Nothing, Jon Snow?
Yep, that's right.
which is our Game of Thrones podcast that you, myself, and from the state of Michigan, Eric, will be joining us again to discuss the new, very abbreviated, I think, what is it, an episode, 8-episode or 7-episode season?
I think it's 7, actually, yeah.
7-episode season of season 7 of Game of Thrones.
Yes, that's right. So that'll be coming back in a couple of weeks. Folks can find that under its own feed. Basically, You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, at Game of Thrones podcast under Google, Stitcher, iTunes, and also under the Dark Discussions podcast feed. And everything can be found at darkdiscussions.com, where you can also download and listen to each and every episode of the Dark Discussions podcast, You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, Searching for American Gods podcast, among a couple of others. We do have some feedback on just generally American Gods in general, from Catherine Gray. We have something from Kevin Letts. We have something from Dan Lynch. And we have something, I believe, from Sean Quinn Robinson as well. So we do have some user feedback on the show and the podcasts and their interpretations of stuff. Anything else that you wanted to bring up, Mike, specific to American Gods or any other house cleaning items that you wanted to bring up?
No, this is our final episode of the first season. With luck, we'll be back for a second season. The show will be back, I imagine, next year. Correct?
Yeah.
Probably next summer on Starz, and hopefully we'll be able to bring the podcast back with it.
Absolutely. Though we will be taking a hiatus after tonight's episode for about 9 months, folks, don't worry. You still can listen to us, as Mike stated, on You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, which re-debuts in 2 weeks. Never mind Dark Discussions podcast, which is a weekly podcast, and it's generally on new releases of genre films. So, for example, a couple of our last releases have been The Hounds of Love, an Australia thriller. We did an episode recently on Lore, L-U-R-E, which is a Polish horror musical. We did an episode on Alien Covenant. So we do mainstream films as well. And we have
We'll be doing an upcoming episode on 47 Meters Down, another theatrical release.
Yep, that's right. And one's coming up on Wonder Woman as well. We've already recorded It Comes in the Night. And we also recorded The Berlin Syndrome, which both have not been released yet. But for our example, the last five episodes that we did were The Hounds of Love, the 1999 Roman Polanski, Johnny Depp film, The Ninth Gate. We did 2001's Donnie Darko. We did, as I said, the Polish film, The Lore. And then we did Alien Covenant. So those were the last five episodes that have been released. And this week we are releasing It Comes at Night, which will come out this Friday. Actually, it'll probably come out Thursday because Friday I have the day off, and so I'll be spending that day with my wife. Okay, so let's read some of the feedback we have from folks. The first one I'll do is Kevin Letts. He sent it through instant message, and this is what he has to say. Listening to the recent American Gods episode, yes, I don't watch the show, and I'm not pretending I do. I had a good laugh, though, about Mike's comment about Irish Jesus not sharing the wine. Also, if Jesus was Irish, he'd probably turn the water to whiskey or beer. I'm sure he'd still share, though. I still listen to the podcast, though, because I am a gaming fan, as you folks have discussed, and a huge supporter and fan of Dark Discussions podcast and its offshoots. I don't watch any of the TV shows you cover. I stopped watching Game of Thrones after season one because of the nudity and sex, but I still enjoy hearing you all talk about the episodes. Have a fantastic day. All right, very good. Thank you, Mr. Letts. So that's nice, short and sweet, just to follow up from his last comment from us.
And just be clear, we all know that Jesus was not Irish because, you know, he was wandering around the desert, and the Irish, we don't do well in the sun.
That is true. That is true. One of my coworkers has a French last name because she married a Frenchman, but she's as Irish as she can get, and yeah, she burns like a mother bleeper, and so has even unfortunately had some skin cancer tags that she had to get removed. So yes, the Irish do not do well in the sun, Mike. That's what I'm told. Living in Boston, I'm surrounded by them. All right, so here we go from Elizabeth Catherine Gray of Archivist Bet on Sexy Witches podcast, genre podcast where she interviews genre and speculative fiction, film, and writers, as well as discusses movies and all things that are nerd or geek, depending on your perspective. So this is what she has to say about the American Gods podcast, as well as the show. And she starts with, Mike, I really enjoyed the final two episodes of American Gods. Still shouldn't have taken until the finale to have Odin speak his own name, however. These final two episodes were not only entertaining, but do have some personal connections, as the mythos covered were something I am very familiar with. My mother was a modern Wiccan, and the Irish religion that was on display was certainly a modified version of that. They even used the word Samhain, pronounced Samhain.
Samhain.
Yeah, she spells it S-O-W, but that can go so or sow. So Samhain. And basically she spells it correctly, but then in parentheses she spells the phonetic spelling of it, saying of it, which still isn't necessarily correct for me because I said so, S-O-W, instead of sow, S-O-W, so whatever. They even used the word Samhain and pronounced it correctly in episode 7. This is something that True Blood failed to do and lost me. If I could interject for a second, if you anglicize the word Samhain, is how it's been pronounced. So technically, you could say that either pronunciation is correct, in my opinion, but so be it. Then she goes, Oester is the Wiccan equivalent of Ostara and an aspect of the triple goddess. And Philip, to answer your question, yes, my mother prayed to her and to the Fae. The Fae may not be gods themselves, but they are spirits that can be helpful or harmful, so keeping them happy is always a good thing. So while Mad Sweeney is not a deity himself, there are plenty of people still giving offerings to him. In fact, the one infuriating thing in the finale is when Wednesday goads Easter, telling her no one is praying to her. This is simply not true, and I am surprised the showrunners completely ignored the modern pagan movement and her growing popularity. But all throughout the finale, Votan is blatantly lying to her, so maybe that is the point. Mr. Nancy does remind us how big a liar Votan is. If I could interject again, technically, she, as well as me and you, Mike, would not know this because we don't know if Neil Gaiman had this in the book, and therefore it would be his quote-unquote mistake and not the showrunners. But again, we're not quite sure. And to continue, I loved Kristen Chenoweth as Easter. I loved all the Christian deities and the party, too. This is one of those sequences you can watch and find something new to love every time. And I love how the storylines are finally merging. Easter and Bilquist are both fertility goddesses. Easter, however, is also a goddess of rebirth and nature, while the Nubian goddess is more of a love goddess. Both are very powerful and dangerous. In fact, all the women in American gods are powerful and are still underestimated by their male counterparts. That was also Mr. Nancy's point. Being able to control nature is power, and the implications of Easter holding back the spring confirms what I thought all along. To attack the new gods is a war against all humanity. Odin is starving humans to force worship. Mr. World is humanity incarnate. This confirms to me Mr. Wednesday is not really a hero at all. He is a villain, and the new gods are really more concerned with self-preservation. Mr. World knows media and technology, or Techno Boy, are fleeting spirits, and he is trying to make sure that the old gods are feeding the new ones by these deals. Mr. World really doesn't want a war. He wants to solidify his pantheon so it endures as well as the old gods have. It's a losing battle, in my opinion. What a unique show. I hope the vague narrative stuff ends now that Shadow has accepted the truth. I hated knowing more than our main character. It just slowed the plotting down in an already confusing show. But I am in for a second season. And with a cast like this, it's easy to see why Starz has really backed this show. Hooray for Cable, a rare thing to say, but we wouldn't have this show otherwise. Thanks for the recap show, because American Gods needed one. Until Game of Thrones, this is the head huntress signing out. All right, very good. So, yes, she was able to... I guess enjoy the final episode, especially since it did have a lot to do with it appears at least her mother's belief system, and so she got to see a lot of things that she could relate to much more than I guess a regular layperson. At least that's what it sounds like to me, Mike. What about you?
Yeah, I know she's got a Wiccan background, and her mother was a Wiccan. I don't know if her mother is still with her. And I believe she follows many of the same practices, but I've never really gotten that kind of conversation with her. I still think that when you look at, you know, the pagan or Wiccan religions right now, they are a very, very small slice of the populace in the United States. Even if it's growing, it's not growing from a particularly large base. So I imagine when Wednesday says that nobody prays to you anymore, yeah, it may not be nobody, but it's nothing probably in comparison to what she had in the old days. Although the population is a lot bigger, so it could be that the small slice of the population that is praying to her now might be comparable in size to what she was praying to her back then. But anyway, as a percentage of the population, it's not a whole lot. And probably not nearly as much as the people who are recognizing her as the goddess of marshmallow Easter bunnies. So, yeah, I mean, it's, and you know, it's a point of fiction, and yes, I think he definitely was trying to goad her. He's goading her into, what do you call, into joining his side, and he's not going to do that by saying nice things,
right? Or at least to get her to give up neutrality, because at the moment she's fairly neutral, and like you said, this goads her into his side. I'm curious what other folks had thought about it, but it wasn't really spoken of much on the Facebook page or anywhere because I didn't really go off and read anything. But was Easter or Ostara too naive and fell for it too easily or not? And I don't know. That's a question I'm sure some folks probably have felt. Because if she's that all-powerful and clever to at least hook on to Christianity to survive, you would think that she would be a little more, I guess, not be fall for deception as much. But I don't know. Maybe she was always wanted to anyway, and that was she just needed that little push. I don't know. So we got Sean Quinn Robinson, and this is what he has to say. American Gods, Episode 8. Come to Jesus. And this is what he goes on to say. Wow, I'm actually surprised at how rounded the finale was. I really need to read the book again so I can address the differences. Answers abound, threads tie together, and Wisconsin and the House on the Rock are on the horizon. I've been to the House on the Rock, and its relevance in the book is fantastic, so I can't wait to see it in Season 2. Yes, they're going to film on location, which has me really excited. I think we may have read that little blurb last week because he posted it prior to our recording last week. But obviously it makes more sense now that the season finale has been seen by everybody. Anything you got to say about that, Mike? I know you mentioned the House on the Rock, what it was last week. You said something about it being a tourist trap type place.
It is a tourist trap type place, but I really don't know a whole lot about it. I've never been there. I've never even been to the state of Wisconsin. I'm not that big with cheese, but so I don't know. I've heard a little bit about it, but not a lot. It's something I might be tempted to stop in if I'm ever there, but yeah, I don't know anything right now.
All right, very well. And Dan Lynch, he actually wrote this a little while back, and I don't think we've ever read it. It may have been because it says something that we didn't know about, unless you're very, able to catch things that others wouldn't. But this is what he says. He goes, Dan Lynch states, Phil and Mike, I have been following you as usual, thoughtful and simply marvelous podcasts on American Gods. Bravo, gents, pure delight. Disclosure, I have read both Gaiman's American Gods and Anansi Boys, which is supposed to be the follow-up to American Gods, or at least a loose follow-up. And when you're done podcasting, do yourselves a favor and read both of them. It's kind of fun listening to the cherry popping, and I won't give up any major spoilers, but you are both correct. Revenant is the right term for Shadow's ex-wife. And I can't remember which of you initially thought Crispin Glover might be Loki, and obviously you know now he's Mr. World, but did you know you've actually met Loki in Episode 1 already? And then Sean Quinn Robinson states that he conferred with a friend, and sure enough, Loki was in a cameo in Episode 1. So most likely will play a bigger role in Season 2, I guess. We may have read that prior, but I can't remember offhand. So no harm rereading it if it so happens that we are reading it a second time. Any further thoughts you wanted to say about any of the comments, emails, or anything, Mike?
Now, I think I know who Loki is. I think it's somebody who was in the prison at the beginning. Yeah, a lot of that, but it was my guess as to who Loki was when I just heard Crispin Glover was cast. I knew that Ian McShay was Odin, and he seemed like a natural fit for Loki, but obviously he's Mr. World. I'm just trying to decide right now, not in a rush, but do I want to read the book between now and the second season, or do I just want to continue? Like, I've avoided reading the books for Game of Thrones, which of course is a lot easier to do because they're much bigger and longer. Because I started with the show not knowing what was going to happen, and I've tried to stay to that. With American Gods, I'm feeling like I kind of want to have some ideas the direction it's going, but I don't know if I want to read the book before or after the show has had a chance to play out. And I haven't made up my mind on that yet.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I will even read the book later, just for the fact that I have so many things to read anyway and so forth. But I may. But yeah, maybe I may pick it up before, you know, at the library, because you can get it at the library for free to rent or borrow, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, maybe I'll do that over the winter. We have plenty of time to do it though, Mike, right? 10 months.
Yeah.
So, now, when we decided to do this show, there was a couple of interesting things that could have been done, Mike, because at the time this came out, the following week, Twin Peaks and I guess The Handmaid's Tale were two other fairly popular shows that appeared at the same time. And I guess we could have chose any of them, assuming we wanted to do any of them. I suggested this one to you because I've heard so much about the book, or be honestly, I've heard so much about Neil Gaiman more than the book, and I knew this was one of his most popular works, and so I was curious to learn more about Gaiman, and I figured this show would be a good way to start. But honestly, if Twin Peaks came a week earlier and was on a different station, because that's actually on Showtime, which I don't have, I may have suggested that instead. What about you? What's your thought about saying that we chose to do this rather than say either others, and were either others even on your radar as something that would have interested you had we chose one of them instead of American Gods as a podcast?
And other shows. I mean, there's all sorts of other shows. You know, there's only so much time, and even just doing the second podcast a week, I find kind of eats up more of my time than I'm sometimes comfortable with. And it's really just a couple of hours a week, but it's just one more night that I'm kind of pigeonholed. And I don't know if you feel the same way, but it's just amazing how different it is when we're not doing that second podcast, whether it was the Game of Thrones podcast or this one or the Westworld podcast. For me, it was kind of liberating only having to do the one episode a week. But there's a lot of shows on the air that I would always be willing to do podcasts about. I know I'm the only one on the podcast who's a fan of The Walking Dead, but that's obviously one. But you also have things like Preacher or the new Mist series that just came out. I caught the first episode, is really solid. There was Penny Dreadful when that was on the air. Yeah, there's no shortage of stuff that I would always love to talk about, but we're really living in a time of embarrassing riches when it comes to genre television. Even stuff that's not really genre, like Better Call Saul, is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you could argue it depends on what your definition of genre is, right? I mean, if we're talking about speculative fiction genre, then Better Call Saul wouldn't be genre. But if we're talking about genre in general, which would include even stuff like westerns and thrillers and police procedurals, then Better Call Saul could easily fit into genre television for sure. But yeah, you're right. There is a lot of stuff. I do say that this show felt a little harder to do than others for a number of reasons. Like you said, obviously it's we're recording twice a week when we do this extra podcast. But work has been hugely busy for the last 5.5 months for me that finally may have had a break starting yesterday, which is very liberating. So this one was definitely a little harder. I understand your point about Game of Thrones or Westworld, but those shows I was so engrossed in that it was actually fun to talk about them because they were like event TV rather than just another good show. So I even though it quote-unquote pigeonholed a night where I was booked to record, it was something that I kind of look forward to. While American Gods, Searching for American Gods, even though it's a good show, it's not an event show like those shows were. So it wasn't necessarily as exciting as I know how you felt, Mike, when sometimes we do an episode on Dark Discussions and it's a film that you find out that you didn't like as much or someone else chose that isn't a film that necessarily you want to do. It may not be as exciting as doing, say, right. a movie that you like. So I see your point. So here, yeah, I mean, I don't know. If I was watching Twin Peaks or something else, maybe I would have preferred to have done that instead of American Gods, because American Gods is just such a odd show. In other words, I don't even know if it's an odd show. It may just be mystical, not mystical realism, but urban fantasy, I guess. I guess it's an urban fantasy. And I'm not a huge urban fantasy person, even though it's like one of the most popular genres in literature, and now it appears moving to TV than anything else, because I mean Penny Dreadful and True Blood are urban fantasies too, and yet True Blood, at least the first few seasons, I actually enjoyed more so than American Gods. I guess we'll discuss all sorts of things, like our final opinions of the season. Who was a couple of questions I have, Mike, which is like, who is your favorite supporting character or actor that only appears in one episode, you know, things like that, which we can go over later in the episode. But compared to other genre shows, and I know you've watched a lot more than me, and Eric has probably, from Dark Discussions, watched even more than me or you combined, probably. But obviously he's not here. But compared to other shows that you've seen that are genre-related or speculative fiction-related, where would you rank American Gods?
I don't want to keep rehashing everything we've said. It's one of these things where I think the strengths are really strong and the weaknesses are kind of are also there, and we've kind of beaten those to death. I think it's a tantalizing series. I would have liked it to go a little further in the storyline than it did. I think it has the potential to be a great series because I think the casting is fantastic. I think the visuals are fantastic. And at least scene by scene, the writing is really good. It's working on it as a cohesive whole that it's sort of not working as well as it could. And that happens a lot with first seasons of TV shows. So, I don't find it yet as gripping as Game of Thrones or Westworld, which were also a little bit simpler in there, which Westworld was certainly simpler in its narrative. But I think, like, I prefer to say, you know, Bates Motel just finished up. I prefer to that show's first season. Or Preacher's first season. So I like the season quite a bit. I don't know, but I will be honest, I don't know how devastated I would be if it hadn't gotten a second season.
Yeah, without a second season, this would have been a disaster, right? Because, I mean, it doesn't end, right?
I mean,
they made this first 8 episodes assuming there was going to be a season 2, because otherwise there is no ending. It just is weird.
Right, yeah. And also say, like, I'll compare it to on HBO, you have The Leftovers, which I know you like a lot, and it's a solid series, but it doesn't appeal to me personally in quite the same way. And it's something that I haven't been in. We've got the third season on our DVR. We just haven't gotten around to watching it, and I'll watch it, but I don't know how much it's a series I would ever revisit either. So I probably prefer American Gods to that, at least after 1 year. So it's not that the other one is bad. It's just a matter of personal taste.
Yep. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. Unfortunately, I really can't compare it because I haven't really seen that many genre television shows. I usually don't have enough time to do so, and I need a little more variety. Otherwise, I get burned out quick, unless it's something like Game of Thrones, which, you know, you could tie me to a chair and play it over and over and over and feed me through a test tube, and I would be fine because that show is just so awesome. But yeah, generally other stuff, it's tough. So I've only really seen Westworld, Game of Thrones, a couple of the first four seasons of The Walking Dead, Breaking Bad, and Sons of Anarchy, and two seasons of Bates Motel, one season of Colony, and two seasons of Strain. And that's about it for television, you know, modern television the last, you know, 8 years or whatever. Not including stuff like House of Cards, the first two seasons, and I'm not even bothering with the next season because the second or three seasons, though. The last season was so bad, I don't even know if I'm going to watch the new one.
I did actually just finish watching it, and I liked it, but a lot of that is because I've resolved myself to the fact that it has gone from being sort of political thriller to complete political fantasy, and things that they're it has far less grounding in reality than the show had in its first season. The first season had one moment that made me wish they hadn't gone that far, and now it's just completely over the top. But I think it still handles it well. Once you just have to accept the thing that they did the last season.
Right. Yeah. No, that's I see your point. To compare it against all that stuff, I would say that obviously Game of Thrones is my favorite. And then Westworld is probably number two. I loved True Blood for its good running time, because it just had some pretty cool storylines, good B movie exploitation, blood and boobs and craziness and stuff, and so I actually enjoyed that a lot.
How far did you get in that series?
I got to the point right where she finds out she's a fairy.
Yeah, that's about where it starts going down the crapper.
Okay, and the reason I stopped watching it after that was because obviously there was the break. And then I think something happened. I think my first kid was born or something, or I got married or something came up. And then I just got swamped. And by the time I had time again to get into it, I had forgotten all the story. And so I didn't want to rewatch season whatever again so I could know where I was supposed to be on the next season. But you're saying that it kind of jumps the shark at that point anyway?
Yeah, it starts becoming more... There's always soap opera elements in it in the terms of the constant mixing of relationships and twists and turns kind of coming out of nowhere and over-the-topness of that. And it's... she's sleeping with this character now, and now it's this character, and now this one is doing that and that. And, you know, it just started getting silly and started getting played out. There were still good moments in it, and you know there were good character moments and good character arcs here and there. But I think the last season just didn't really work, and it became harder. And it really had jumped the shark, probably in season. I'm thinking season four, if I'm out of the six.
Okay.
So the last three was kind of tough.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's right about where I lost watching it. Dexter was a good show too. So I think this would be my lower third out of all those shows that I've named. Because it's not obviously one of the best, because it wasn't an event television. And out of the stuff that I've liked that isn't event television, like True Blood or Dexter or whatever, it's not as good as those, I felt, either.
Well, I think Dexter had a terrible eighth season. And it's regarded as having a solid fourth season, and then it got very iffy after that. I thought the sixth season with Edward James Olmos was a complete waste of time. There was good stuff in the seventh season, but it didn't sustain itself throughout. And then the eighth season just kind of, I thought, shat the bed.
Right. Well, obviously, a lot of folks say these things, you know, Lost is another one or whatever. So, yeah, if you take certain parts of it, obviously it lowers it. But if you take the best parts of Lost or the best parts of Dexter or the best parts of True Blood, I enjoyed them more so than American Gods is all I guess I'm saying, which doesn't necessarily mean I did not enjoy American Gods. It just means it wasn't what I was hoping it to be, I guess. I was expecting it to be maybe event TV stuff like Westworld or Game of Thrones turned out.
Well, I don't know what you mean by event TV.
I think we kind of explained it last week. Basically, event TV would be, or as you call it, Mike, the water cooler talk the next day, or as I stated, the people who would all go to a bar or to their friend's house and they would all watch the show together.
Well, but that's not necessarily an aspect of the show. That's how popular the show is. And something's on Stars, people just aren't going to watch it. I mean, there's a limit to the number to the numbers it's going to get.
Yes, but what I mean is if the show was awesome, I mean it's good, but it's not awesome. I think it would get buzz. Much, yeah, you know, I mean, because, you know, Walking Dead is on, what, AMC, I guess? HBO has Game of Thrones. I mean, various shows have various things, or various television stations have various shows, but I think they're able to break through if there's enough buzz.
Well, but a lot of those shows also didn't break through in the first season. You know, Game of Thrones piled up. It wasn't really until episode 9 of the first season that people were talking about it, and even then it wasn't something I would hear people talking about in the teacher's lounge. You know, same thing Walking Dead, it wasn't probably until third season that people were really talking about that.
Well, then I guess I'm being figurative, meaning the show simply isn't something I like as much as those.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, I guess that should have been all I should have said. Now, out of all the episodes, what was your favorite episode or the one that you felt was the strongest? Because, again, the high point is obviously the cast, Catherine Elizabeth Gray. Catherine Gray specifically mentioned that as a high point for this television show, whether or not it's great or not.
I'm running through the 8 episodes in my head. You know, weirdly enough, the 2 standalone episodes I really liked were sort of standalones, which were the ones about Laura and Mad Sweeney. I really enjoyed those.
Do you think it's because of Emily Browning? Because she pretty much was the lone star in both of those.
Well, you know, I think I'm going to say the cast as a whole is phenomenal. And, like, I think the character of Shadow Moon isn't all that gripping as a central character at the start of the series. But I think when you get to that episode 4 and you see him in a flashback, he's a very different person. and it feels like a different person. The actor is playing him differently, which is appropriate. And I found him much more compelling there than it did when he's kind of dealing with the, the death of his wife. He's got kind of a chip on his shoulder, and he's certainly a bit depressed. And I am not invalid, and that's the way he should be. That's kind of the way he should be played. But it just wasn't as compelling as to watch as a viewer. Where I think, Laura was a lot of fun as a character, as an actress to watch. I think all of them, like, I really liked Kristen Chenoweth as Easter. I thought it was fantastic. And certainly Gillian Anderson was really good. And Crispin Glover and his little bits were really good. And Ian McShane was really good. And that's part of what's selling the series, is the way they write the characters for me. But yeah, I would say probably 4 and 9 were the ones I liked the most.
There is no 9, so you mean 7.
4 and 7, right. I was thinking it was a 10 season. Yeah, 10 episode season. And then other than that, maybe the police station episode, which is where we finally meet Mr. Worrell, which was, I guess, episode 5?
Yeah, I think you're right.
So.
Yeah. I would agree. The two best ones are the two standalones that Emily Browning starred in, I felt. I enjoyed them the most. I liked her flashback or her introduction one the best because, oddly, it was more drama and more in the real world. I know a lot of people have felt her character was a negative weirdo or whatever, but I enjoyed her character a lot, and as a character study piece, it was really good. And then, of course, the one about her as the Irish girl was just plain fun as well. So,
And she's not a good character in that she's not a good person for a lot, or not, an upstanding person necessarily. She's manipulative. She's a bit shallow. She's selfish, but she's a good character to watch.
Yes, absolutely.
She may be on a redemptive path. We'll see what ends up happening with her.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, absolutely. And to be honest, there's a lot of folks that I felt I like that in the real world, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean, her character felt perfectly like the everyday man in literary fiction, struggling with life, as you said when we were discussing that episode, first world problems, but generally first world problems or in the world that you happen to be from can make you still feel depressed and lonely and at a dead end, even if you do have food and water and a house. So, and that's what a lot of classic or literary fiction is about. People who aren't necessarily homeless, but just regular middle-class folk who feel like their life is meaningless. John Updike is another example of an author that writes stuff like that. Ann Tyler is another. So that, I think that's the reason why I liked that episode the best and did not really dislike her character, even with all those flaws that you mentioned, Mike, because I've read so many books with characters like that her issues weren't necessarily something that made me poo-poo her, as I read other bloggers state when they first saw her character.
Well, you have a problem when you introduce Shadwick's character, and he's, I think, played rather sympathetically. And then you kind of introduce her 4 episodes later or 3 episodes later, and you know that she's been cheating on him, and you see that she's manipulated him and that he's more devoted to her than she is to him. And if you're on Shadow's side, it's very easy to understand why people are not going to come around or going to have a hard time coming around to her character. and her point of view. And I see this in a lot of shows and a lot of stories, where when people latch on to one character's point of view, the lead characters usually, if they have a hard time seeing it from somebody else's, from another character. And they just want, well, why can't they facilitate the success of the character I've been rooting for instead of being their own independent person? And the reality is, most people in a relationship are probably in a relationship where one person loves the other more than the other way around, because it's just people are different and things happen. It doesn't mean that they don't love the person or that there isn't an attraction there. It's just things sometimes are on different levels.
Now, am I a minority in the sense that when Shadow's character felt so much of a side character, even though he was supposed to be the lead the first three episodes, that my sympathies for him, which I did have, but I didn't really empathize with him that much of a character, because I guess I was focusing more of my attention on Mr. Wednesday. And so when we finally hit Laura episode four, I didn't have as much of a negative feeling for her right out of the first minute of that episode, just for the fact that I guess I didn't really empathize with Shadow. So was I in the minority, or do you think Wednesday really could have made other people like myself just overwhelm, you know, those other three episodes prior to episode four?
I think the problem is his character is passive. He's led around by the nose for most of those first couple of episodes. Even when you look at when he gets lynched in the first episode, he doesn't save himself. You know, he's saved by, well, what we later learn is Laura, right? But he's not someone who, who's in control of his own destiny. He is being manipulated the whole time by Wednesday, and I think that's part of what makes Wednesday an interesting character, or because he's the one that's leading the way. He's the one in control. He's the one with the answers. And I think that people just find that inherently more interesting. And Shadow wasn't even asking that many questions, right? So you take a look at a lot of those, the Joseph Campbell stuff, the hero's journey, and whatever is a Luke Skywalker. It's they want to go forward. They are asking questions. They are involved in their success where he never really is. He's just Wednesday says this and he does this. I mean, he's not completely passive. He resists. He doesn't want to do it, but he allows himself to be swindled into taking a job he doesn't really want. He's dealing with the fact that, you know, he's still dealing with the fact that he's just got out of prison. His wife died and his best friend died, and she was sucking his cock in the car at the time. And he never really has a chance to deal with that. And he's not asking questions about who Wednesday is and what he's doing and why he's doing it and what his long-term plans are. And that sort of he's like our identification character, right? The audience introduction character. Like, remember the first X-Men movie? You had the character of Rogue was basically our doorway, or Will Smith in Men in Black, right? They're our doorway into this world.
Sure, sure. The point of perspective character.
The point of view, right. And that's basically what Shadow is serving as, but we have questions. He's not answering them. He's not asking them. He's not discovering them. And we're kept in the dark until literally until episode 8, when he says, "I'm Odin." And by that point, I imagine a lot of people had already figured that out. Like Elizabeth Catherine Gray said, is that we are far ahead of where Shadow is most of the show.
Right, right, exactly. Which honestly is fair, because obviously Shadow doesn't know he's in a supernatural world, right? I mean, we're watching the show. We already know that this is some sort of urban fantasy, and we already know certain things. He's supposed to be in a real world until the moment he meets Wednesday, I guess. And
right, well, like for most of us, we understand that if we go watch a movie called The Howling and there's, you know, we hear growling noises under the light of a full moon, we know that there's a werewolf involved in the film, right? And so we are, that's something where we're expected to be ahead of the character. But we don't, but we can at least understand the character not knowing it. Here the character doesn't know, but doesn't seem that inclined to want to find out. And I think that might be one thing with Browning's character, is that after she dies and comes back, she's taking action on her own. Right? She's moving on her own volition to find her best friend, you know, and apologize for the banging her and try to get her arm sewed back on. And, you know, she goes and rescues Shadow. She's not taking shit from Matt Sweeney. She's a far more active and engaging character than Shadow is.
Right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And again, that may be just a personality thing. I mean, a lot of folks said that about certain characters in Game of Thrones. And then, you know, now they're favorites of some people, while at the beginning of the show they weren't. And maybe that's what's going to happen to Shadow. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are probably like Shadow. I mean, they're not superheroes like Lara has become. So I guess that isn't as engaging. When things happen and overwhelm people, a lot of people are more apt to be like Shadow's character rather than let's go kick ass, even though I have no money, no house, and no family, you know. So I guess it's more interesting to see a character like Alara than a Shadow, even if a Shadow is a more realistic character, I guess.
Yeah, but there's a reason why we know, you know, throughout history, we know the stories of Hercules and Perseus and Beowulf,
And Siegfried,
thank you. That's what I was looking for. And we don't know the story of Cyrus, the herb merchant. You know, it's people don't really, as a rule, they want to see stories that they can escape from that are a bit of wish fulfillment in some way, shape, or form, not necessarily just, oh, let's look at somebody else's realistic, dreary life and the monotony of their life. Because that's not what we're interested in. That's not what fascinates us. You know, and I know there's a market for that. There are people who want to read very real books about, well, it's a real book about a real person going through real pain and real problems. But I'm not even saying that it has to be a James Bond or a Superman, but it has to be something you want to put yourself in those person's shoes and, you know, wonder what would you do in that position or live through them vicariously. And I think we'd have a lot more fun with being Laura right now than being Shadow.
Yep. Yep, exactly, exactly. And to be honest, not including, I guess, the big reveal, quote-unquote big reveal, I think everybody would have wanted to be Wednesday instead of Shadow 2 during all those episodes that they were being Bonnie and Clyde or Abbott and Costello, if you prefer. The more interesting character, the more funny character, the more wild character, and the more interesting or well-written character, plus the actor that plays that character, makes Wednesday's character so much more, I'm going to use the term endearing, but I mean, you can use almost any term if exciting, if you prefer.
And endearing. I mean, it's that he's a bit of a scoundrel, right? But we can like scoundrels. That's how Harrison Ford got a lot of mileage out of Indiana Jones and Han Solo, is that they were
similar to Wednesday.
They were similar. They were rapscallions, right? They weren't. You know, that's why people hate the Han doesn't shoot first in the remastered version of Star Wars, because, yeah, he's a bit of a dick, and they shoot somebody under the table, but we kind of like that, right? But he still does the right thing in the end, right? He comes and saves Luke at the end, spoiler warning, but it's still, he's got a bit of an attitude to him. He's not predictable. When she says, I love you, he says, I know, instead of the written dialogue, and a lot of that came from Harrison Ford. the shooting the Arab with the big sword. You know, it's all that stuff. You know, as a character with a little bit of an element of danger to them, shit that we wish we were cool enough to do.
Anti-hero, I guess.
Yeah.
Or something. There's another term for it. A guy that's generally a quote unquote a crook, but still has a heart of gold and is the good guy. And I thought it was the anti-hero, but it's probably a different term.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a fair point, Mike. That's an excellent comparison. Using the two Han Solo two Harrison Ford characters, because I can see a lot of Wednesday. If his final outcome may not be the same, his build up to that eighth episode felt the same as a Han Solo or a Indiana Jones. I guess, what character did you like that only had a small role? What do you think was your favorite character of the season? Because I had a little tough time trying to think of that myself.
That's really hard, because I liked so many of the characters. And
the actors that played them, too.
And the actors that play them very well. I mean, you obviously... Like, I appreciate Gillian Anderson because it's Gillian Anderson, and she's given some fun stuff to do, but we don't really get to know Media as a character well. In the little bit we see Kristen Chenoweth as Easter, I think she was fantastic.
No, she was awesome, yeah.
I'm trying to... Peter Stormare?
I had never even seen that actress, Kristen Chenoweth, until this show, because I didn't watch her in her other programs. So she was introduced to me. And I was surprised how of a great actress Kristen Chenoweth was. Now, who were you just mentioning, Mike?
It was Peter Stormare. Is that the name of the guy who played Chernobog?
Yeah, Peter Stormare, the Swedish actor, yep.
And, the actress who was the sister. I can't believe I'm blanking on her.
Cloris Leachman?
Cloris Leachman.
Yep.
You have the, was it Salim? What was it, the cab driver or the salesman?
Yeah.
Was one of the most, possibly the most sympathetic character in the entire series so far. And even like somebody like Technology Boy, he's just, for a villain, he's exactly what you want as a villain, because you just want to reach in the screen and punch him in the face. You know, he's just a massive dick. You know, it's,
Did you feel that Selim, we have to go back one character before you bring it up, Techno Boy, Selim, why was he so lovable of a character, even though his demeanor and woe is me about life was similar to Shadow's? And Shadow, it took us longer to, I guess, like, or you know, while we loved Salim almost the moment we met him at the office.
Well, first of all, there's something to be said about the performance of the actors, and I've seen this actor before, and he's just kind of got a dislikable vibe to him. But he's not... He kind of feels that, like, when you first meet him, he feels more like the Charlie Brown character, where Shadow's got more of a chip on his shoulder, right? Where somebody just keeps... has, you know, had the shit kicked out of him. He's and we've all been in that position. We haven't all been in the position of getting out of prison to find out our wife has died with somebody else's cock in their mouth. You know, we've all been in the position of, you know, being stuck in the waiting room and having our, you know, appointment canceled or something like that. You know, it's so I think that kind of gets us already on his side. And then when he does get what he wants, he gets his life flipped. He trades positions with the djinn. Then there's a positiveness about his character. He's only beaten down for a little bit, you know, in that segment in that one episode. And there's also, he's reaching out to the djinn. He's hopeful. He entertains immediately just the fact that he grasps that, oh, I'm with a genie, right? This is where Shadow still is cluelessly wandering around with a Norse god. He figures out the cab driver is a djinn almost immediately, and toys with the idea and realizes this is a and starts probing him with questions, and you know, respect done so in a respectful way. Plus, there is that that sense of attraction, and whatever your sexuality, we've all been in the position of, well, I like that person. I don't know if they like me, and can I probe that? And what can I find? You know, will this go anywhere? But you're also afraid to push it because you don't want it to blow up in your face either. And so I think we could identify with him on that. There's a lot of, I think, stuff that we can directly identify with him. But it's just, and it just, again, feels more like an upbeat and positive character, even if he's going through a lot of shit.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I think that's pretty much exactly why we like him almost immediately. Obviously, you stated the actor has a general charisma anyway, but I think you're right. He is more self-aware of his situation, I guess, to add to what you said, than, say, Shadow. I mean, Shadow's just down in the dumps. Well, this guy is down in the dumps, too, but feels like he's very aware, and he's also I liked how he took everything as a joke, like, you know, life is just a joke, and I'm here, and I just got to deal with it, because, and, you know, he knows that he's just selling junk. He knows that there's a chance that this guy in the office that we never meet, that he has an interview with, will never see him, and he just takes it with stride, and he sucks it up. He doesn't complain. And he doesn't go woe is me publicly anyway. And I think that makes him feel more real to, I guess, the average viewer, because everybody, you're running in place, basically. You can run as fast as you want, but you're running in place. And he was an epitome of that, I think, his character.
Right. Well, you know, let's go back to the Star Wars analogy again. With a lot of people criticize Hayden Christensen in Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith, the way he played Anakin Skywalker.
Overacting, maybe, is a lot of people.
Well,
say.
Not that overacting, like, because he was a whiny teenager. But if you read the interviews, that's what George Lucas wanted, because George Lucas had whiny teenagers at home, and he knew what whiny teenagers were like.
Sure.
But he missed the fact that people don't want to spend time with whiny teenagers.
Those type of people. Yeah.
Right. So while we can understand why Shadow would be the way he is, which would be angry and confused and hurt and withdrawn, it doesn't mean it's a fun thing to watch.
Right.
And where Salim, I think, was just more fun. And for that matter, Emily Browning, the way they wrote her character, she was more fun to watch. Now, I'm hoping, because again, I think Shadow was a very different character in that fourth episode, where he was got a lot more life and got a lot more energy because he hasn't gone to prison yet, and his wife hasn't died with someone else's dick in their mouth. He's a more pleasant character to be around, and we see his face light up when he sees Laura at the end of that eighth episode. So yeah, that may be a sign that the character will snap out of it and be a little bit more enjoyable to be around.
Right, right. And I think that's what's going to happen, because obviously he is the lead. I mean, no matter how strong all these peripheral characters are, and as a result, the show feels more of like an ensemble cast show, even though it appears that it really isn't. I'm figuring that Shadow will probably have to grow on us somehow, where he's not the overshadowed character, no pun intended, that he happens to be, at least in this first season. Now, what one character I felt that was really good, that was very short-lived meaning only in the show for maybe 8 to 10 minutes, was the Zoria Polonochnaya character, which was the Midnight Star actress or goddess. That would be Cloris Leach. What's that?
She was the one that was in the bedroom in the second episode, and we only saw like in the dream sequence or something in the third.
Exactly. The one that was in the dream sequence in the third. I felt that was one of the best dream sequences I've ever seen in anything. Because a lot of times, I forget who said it, but one of our listeners, A Dark Discussion, stated that dream sequences always felt to them to be just a weakness in storytelling, so they add a dream sequence to get jump scares or get something out to the audience, or they just turn out to be nothing more than interesting vignettes. But I felt in this one, not only was it an interesting vignette, but I felt her character was very, I don't want to say dreamy, I want to say very, or I don't want to say informative either. I'm trying to think of a more interesting word to use. But her character felt like she was actually leading Shadow in a way that everybody else, in other words, she was, felt like the first character to want to help Shadow rather than use him. And the way she played that role with her accent, and of course just being in the dream sequence and dark on the roof looking at the stars, made it feel more exotic, I guess. And I felt she played the role excellently, that this actress. And so I liked that character a whole lot, even though she only was in the whole series so far for 10 minutes.
Right. I think when you're dealing with, you know, you mentioned It Comes at Night, right? We did
That's right. The
review of that film. And that's a film where I really didn't like the dream sequences because they, to me, and I know some people have said that the dream sequences are the key to understanding the whole film. But I didn't feel like I had trouble understanding the film, and the dream sequences felt to me like a way to artificially amp up the tension most of the time.
Sure.
To go, oh, scary shit happens. That doesn't really happen. And, you know, ooh, I woke up. All right, you know, that to me felt cheap and lame. In an otherwise good film. In this, because you're dealing with gods, and dreaming is part of how things go with God, and it's one way that gods communicate with people, but it didn't feel like it didn't happen, right? It felt like that was a real meeting between the characters.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. It's a quote-unquote dream, but it was real. If that makes any sense, right? I mean, it was like she was in his mind and actually there communing with him, right?
And it makes a difference. It makes a difference in, right, that Shadow then, and one of the few moments in the series, he steps out and challenges Chernabog to another checker game in order to get his life back because he's been empowered by her. She gives him a coin to replace the lucky coin that he lost.
Yep.
Right, and he takes up that challenge, and again, it is one of the few times he becomes the proactive character instead of just a reactionary one.
Right.
So yeah, and I like what you say is that she's the only character that we've met, I think, in the entire series.
I think you're right.
That has not been playing him, either disregarded him because he's immortal, or been trying to use him and manipulate him. Certainly, media was trying to manipulate him. His, you know, Laura was manipulating him and using him. Matt Sweeney beat the crap out of him. You know, and obviously, we know Wednesday's been stringing him along from the beginning. So,
right. And anybody else that he meets either wants to kill him, like Techno Boy, or ignores him. If not maliciously, like Cloris Leachman's character.
Right, and the only other one, you know, to give him any useful advice was the inmate in the first episode who said, don't fuck with the bitches on the in the airport, right?
Oh, right, yeah, that's the, I'm trying to get his name here. Lysmith.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a fair point. That was one of the best little vignette stories I felt in the whole series, actually. When you think that story was going elsewhere. And he goes, it really actually is. In other words, most people were trying to read more into the story, and then really the whole point of the story was, no, you just don't fuck with the woman behind the counter. It has nothing to do with it. There's no symbolism. There's no nothing. You know, you're all reading in all this shit into it, and all I'm trying to tell you is you just don't fuck with the woman behind the counter.
And even that in a larger scale, I guess, if you think about it, the woman at the counter, you don't fuck with her because she has the power.
Right.
Right, and you have to learn.
And I think that's the point. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Well, it's one of these things I try to impart to some of my students is I don't care if you're right. Right, it's
you play the game.
You have to play the game, and if you get yelled at by the teacher and and I'm usually not talking about myself. I'm usually talking about some other teacher kids having problems with. You don't have any cards. You have nothing. Right, you have no power whatsoever. If it comes to challenge between you and the teacher in front of the principal is not going to back you because you're going to be gone within 4 years, and then you're going to be stuck with that teacher until they retire. You know, you have to know how to play the game with the people in charge, and the woman behind the counter is a person in charge. And what happens with a lot of people when they're in charge who are normal people, whether they're the clerk at the DMV, or the stewardess,
or the cop that pulls you over,
they can go a little too far when given a little bit of power, because that little bit of power is all they have.
Right. And they may think they're entitled because they have that quote unquote power over you. However, like you stated, Mike, you don't fuck with the bitch, because if you do, it's going to bite you back, and you're going to have to live with, like, in other words, if it's your boss. You play the game because your boss ain't going anywhere, and if you piss off the boss, you're doomed. You know, if you yell at the cop that pulls you over, guess what's going to happen? You know, you just play the game. And I think having that little vignette at the beginning with this story and its literal meaning rather than its symbolic meaning that everybody was probably thinking it was going to go with is the way to, I don't know. I mean, it sets up the series pretty well, even if the whole series is filled with symbolism.
But you can argue, and I'm just thinking of this now, right, that this is something that is getting applied throughout the entire series, isn't on one hand Odin Wednesday basically someone who's trying to fuck with the power, right? You can view him as the little person behind the counter who has a little bit of power and is trying to use it to get more, or certainly he's playing games with people, but he's also trying to fuck with the people who the new gods who seem to have more power than he does. And maybe that's a problem he's going to have.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right? I mean, Easter or Oesta, until the very end, has been playing the game quite well the past 2,000 years, right? Because, you know, things change, certain things happen, I don't know who said it, but, you know, there's a lot of indispensable men that are in every graveyard, right? And someone comes and replaces you. So if you can survive, you can, you know, like Easter or Ostara did, you know, that Odin refuses to do that, right? Odin wants the power back. He wants to be the leader of the gods in Valhalla like he was, you know, 1,500 years ago, before the Norsemen were turned into Catholics and then eventually Lutherans. So he can't, he's pushing back. And I guess if he turns out to be the villain at the end of the series, it's not going to go well for him, right? I mean,
yeah, I can't imagine, and it could be my lack of imagination, I can't imagine that we're going to find out that Mr. World is the hero of this story, that he and the new gods are good, quote-unquote, good guys, but I also can't imagine... But I can very easily imagine that he's just going to be a different that villain, and Wednesday will be a villain of a different stripe.
Right.
So, well, yeah, it's,
yeah, because he's not a villain in the sense that he's evil, even though you could argue that he is, but he's a villain in the sense that he has lost power and he wants to regain it. So it's basically playing King of the Hill, basically. And depending on how he does it will determine whether or not he's a bad guy or not. Because it's nothing wrong in human nature, or in this case, God nature, to want to get to the top of the hill again.
No, but it's in the nature of how do you do it.
Exactly.
He wants that power, and so he kills Shadow's wife.
Right, right.
And that's what would make him, from to mortal eyes, a villain or an evil god or a bad guy.
Tricks, because Easter still is her own individual, but influences her to do, which is destroy Spring. That is evil too, right? By the humanity or us, right?
Right, and that could always end up being, you know, go back to the metaphor with the students, is that we often joke that if the students ever realize that they outnumber us, 20-1, that we're fucked. But the reality is, if the students ever were to do something with that numerical advantage, they would end up choking on their own power. Right? They would overstep their boundaries. Just like, the people as a group in the United States, we have power. And as long as we're willing to protest peacefully or, submit a written petition or what have you, as long as we stay coloring in the lines, we can exercise that power in limited ways. But if we ever try to force that use of power, if you end up going from a peaceful protest to a riot, then you're going to find out that the power that you have isn't necessarily as good as you thought it was. And it may be that Easter, in playing this famine card, may have overplayed her hand, or may have gotten Odin to overplay his hand.
Right, right. And actually, it's almost like Mussolini and Franco with Hitler. Hitler comes to Franco and Mussolini, he sends envoys to both, and he says, join me in my war, and you can have part of France. Mussolini jumps on board and says, yes, that's a great idea. Franco, we prefer to, remain neutral and not do anything, because he knew that it was stupid, and Easter, seals her fate by pulling a Mussolini instead of a Franco, and as a result, you're right, it's probably going to backfire on both of them, and they're both going to, be washed away by the end of the series, assuming that's, if this is a straight storytelling, that's what's going to happen, I would think, because they overplay their hand, and they're doomed. Versus if Easter just said, you know what, I'm just going to stay what I'm doing right now, which is a pretty good gig, where I still get children getting bunnies and chocolates and all that, and but she she looks at the shiny bauble, which happens to be Odin and superpower again, and she jumps on his ship, and which is kind of, and the whole thing's very odd, Mike, because Techno Boy, what he does was evil. Obviously he tried to lynch the character at the first season, so we're immediately assuming they're the bad guys. And yet now, I'm not even sure if Mr. World is a bad guy at all, even though he is aligned with Techno Boy. And while Techno Boy, if we use another world example, maybe Techno Boy is, the dictatorship that the West hangs out with or works with, because they're pro-West, they're on our side, even though we don't like them. If behind closed doors, but publicly we're allies with them. And I don't know if that's what Mr. World is doing with Techno Boy, or is Mr. World a bad guy too? And in other words, is everybody, all the gods, bad guys, or just self-interest scum?
I get the sense that Crispin Glover, that Mr. World is not going to end up being one of the good guys. That's my sense.
Yeah, it makes sense for the casting anyway. And even he supported the Korean, the Odin bomb, right, which was kind of not necessarily peaceful, no matter what people think of military defenses. I would agree with that. to change topical, for the vignettes, I think my favorite vignettes, I was originally going to say the Inuit or Siberian folk, so the animated version one as my number one, and it could be still a joint number one, but I think my favorite vignette may be the Egyptian woman who dies trying to grab the jar off the shelf, because her character reminded me so much of you know, my great uncles and aunts and grandparents and all that she felt real to me, even if the other one was more interesting, because her, even though she was very negative and angry and all that, similar to, I guess, like an Archie Bunker or something, she still has that heart of gold behind her, and it was proven, because when they weigh her heart, you know, she turns out to have the heart of gold. So I think that was probably my favorite, with the Inuit, Eskimo, Siberian one a close second. I know you mentioned you like the Omen guy a bit, but what was your favorite, Mike? Or do you have a few that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I mean, I want to go back to the Anansi character in the slave ship, just because it's a great performance by Orlando Jones. And he's also just as good in his little bit in the final episode, telling the story of Vilquis. But yeah, I'm with you. I really do like, in that little segment, that Egyptian woman, not only because it's nice how they do this bit with the character, and they draw a character in very quickly, who is feels like a rich an interesting person, but it's also her introduction to Anubis, and I kind of liked him, and it's the way they played his character, because on the one, you know, and we do see him again later, where he was playing with Laura and comes across very differently, where here he's very kind and gentle, which, as I mentioned, is sort of the way that Neil Gaiman fans are used to him sort of portraying death, in sort of an opposite of how we expect, you know, death as the Grim Reaper. He comes as a smiling face and a comforting face, but of course she has a light heart.
You know what? It was almost like Mad Sweeney when he came as death, right? And he takes the Irish woman away. He was coming similar. I mean, he wasn't coming as the Grim Reaper. He was coming as someone to bring you to the other side, in a sense.
Yeah, so just it's a nice story, and it's two good characters, and it does not, unlike some of the other vignettes, it doesn't take forever to get to the point, meaning that we see his character again rather quickly. I think it's the next episode, right? He pops up in episode 4.
He does.
Where, like, Anansi, he's in episode 2, and then we don't see him until episode 8.
Unless you want to count the spider farm in episode 5.
Yeah, okay, well, you could do that if you want. That's a fair point.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's an excellent point too, Mike, that you brought up, that it was episode 3 when we first meet him and the Egyptian woman, for that matter, and episode 4, and yet oddly those scenes that he was in Anubis, especially actually both, because they were both awesome. It feels like I just watched it yesterday. In other words, it was scenes that were near the beginning of the show, or at least the first half of the show, first half of the season, and yet I remember them as vividly as if I watched them yesterday. And I think that also shows how strong each was. And it's not just Anubis, because I think Laura in the second scene where she's yelling at him and saying fuck you and whatever, shows that it's not just him that made the scenes great, as well as I mentioned, you know, the Egyptian woman, immigrant woman, in the first time we saw her. But just those scenes, I felt were vivid, and for whatever reasons, I remember them as clearly as if I just watched them, unlike some of the other shows. I forgot all about that story about the counter clerk at the airport until you brought it up today. And yet that was an awesome scene, and yet I completely forgot about it. While these scenes with Anubis, I like I said, could repeat them to my wife and explain, you know, everything about them. So I think that makes them strong, and I'm not sure why. I think it's just how they were written rather than necessary the one character, even if it is coincidence, both have the same one character in them.
Well, and again, these are meant to be standalone segments, so they're not there to move the story forward. Now, that may undermine the series as a whole, but that's why I say scene by scene, you take any one scene from this series, for the most part, I think they're exceptionally well done. The problem is just stitching them together into a compelling forward momentum, forward narrative. And that's where I think they maybe missed it a little bit. Now that we have several of the pieces come together in this episode, in this final episode, right? And that you've got Sweeney and Laura meeting with Shadow and Odin, and maybe or maybe not Easter ends up joining their parade. Then you also get this final shot of the forces gathering, and you see a bunch of vehicles gathering up at the house on the rock. So maybe things are coming together, and this will get us some forward momentum. And if you look at a lot of shows, and I'll mention both, if you look at both Game of Thrones and Walking Dead, the seasons that have gotten, I think, the most criticism have tended to be seasons where the characters get scattered, and there's a whole lot of interaction.
Yeah, okay, yep.
And you could argue that something similar is happening here. You have some really good actors. Now let's put them together, and let's see what comes as they bounce off each other. And, you know, you see there's a lot of chemistry, like, between Laura and Matt Sweeney. Well, let's bring more characters into that dynamic, and let's see how Matt Sweeney plays against other characters, and how does Laura play against other characters, and how does Shadow interact with somebody other than Wednesday, right? So,
right,
because we saw mostly the same dynamics throughout the season.
Right. Well, and with him, with Wednesday, as I stated many times when we've done each episode of this podcast, was that Ian McShane, he's such a strong actor and personality that he overshadows Shadow to the point of, like, I'm waiting for Shadow's character to stop talking so I can see Wednesday speak again. So you're right, to get him away from, not necessarily get away from Wednesday, but get more characters in the dynamic may make Shadow a more interesting character. Because once again, like I mentioned earlier, you know, in that dream sequence, Shadow was a more interesting character. Or as you mentioned, Shadow was a more interesting character when he was with Laura in the flashback episode 4, but while he's with Wednesday, he's not that interesting, because Wednesday is everything, in a sense. So
right.
So yeah, I guess by bringing everybody together, because we literally are bringing a lot of people together, at least the main characters, Laris, Sweeney, Shadow, Wednesday, and the three new gods, all in one spot at the same time, as well as another interesting character in Easter, that dynamic of this large ensemble cast may bear fruit when we open up in season 2, episode 1, coming up. So it'll be curious to see where they go there. Though I'm thinking they're going to go on a journey again where everybody's going to leave Kentucky and they're going to head to Milwaukee or Wisconsin, as we know, because that's where all the old gods are supposed to meet, even though I'm not even sure who all those old gods are, because the only old gods that we know of are the Germanic Slavic old gods of Chicago, which are Cherb, Bog, and the Three Women, because they haven't really met anybody else. And characters like Billquist haven't even entered into the main storyline.
Well, you have Chernabog and the sisters, although they only invited Chernabog, where he left the sister behind. That always gets back to that last episode where he was kind of ignoring, or rather overlooking Billquist and getting rid of Laura and overlooking the feminine side. You know, Odin is a very manly god. But you have Odin.
Though we did pick up Oester.
Right, they did pick up Easter. So you've got Odin, Easter, Mad Sweeney, even though he's not a god, he's an old leprechaun. You have Chernabog. You have Anansi, Anubis.
Actually, do we have Anubis? Because I don't know if Wednesday has actually ever met Anubis yet, have
he? Right, okay, I don't know if we know.
But Anansi, you're right, he should show up, because he's been, obviously, friendly with Odin.
Right, there was that brief meeting, we saw him have a meeting with the djinn, even though we didn't know it was the djinn at the time.
That's true.
One or two.
Yeah, one or two.
So there's another one that's there.
Yep.
And then we'll see how many others, if there's any new characters introduced next season.
Right. Yes. Let's see. Anything else of note? I brought up some of the vignettes. I brought up some of the peripheral characters as comment topics. And obviously the episodes. What were some of the favorite episodes? And the vignettes. Have I missed anything that you wanted to bring up as a topical point?
No, you kind of, I mean, what I liked, and we kind of hit what we liked, what we didn't like, the characters, the episodes. I think we hit everything that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, all right. So, all right, well, I guess with that, we can probably do our final thoughts on the entire season in general, or American Gods in general. I know you mentioned you may want to read the book, and we have 10 months to do so, which may actually be a smart thing to do, unless we don't want to have anything spoiled, of course. Some final thoughts, Mike. All in all, I think we both liked the episode or the series so far, but I think we're both a little mixed, though, right? I mean, because what they just said through the 8 episodes didn't leave a really exciting finale. And some of the characters are still not necessarily part of the main storyline. What do you think? Do you have... Am I putting words in your mouth, or would you...
I think that it's... I think, like I said, I think the last episode was exciting, but it felt to me like there was...
It should have been penultimate. That should have
penultimate,
been penultimate.
It wasn't... I was looking for something that had a little bit more forward momentum to bring us into the next season and right. Make us really go, oh, I can't wait to see what happens next season. But it still worked for me. I think, like I said, reading the interview with the showrunner, Brian Fuller... they had some issues getting the season to work. I think it was supposed to be longer, and they stepped back, get the episodes to work as they did. They resequenced some things, and I think we're sort of... And because you are in the first season of a series, and you're trying to figure out what works for you and what doesn't work for you. And hopefully they have got a lot of those bugs worked out now. And when there's a second season... Hopefully it'll be a little bit smoother, and these won't be as problems won't be as big an issue going forward. So I think I could enjoy the show on watching the show for what it is, and enjoy it for what it is. And I've enjoyed because I think those moments, like the story of the Egyptian woman, or the seventh episode with the story of the Irish girl, I found that the individual scenes were compelling enough, even though like the bank heist in episode 4 or 5 were compelling enough. Oh, sorry, the bank heist was episode 3, that I was never bored watching it. Right, I never didn't want to be watching the show. And I just felt that they could have been stitched together better.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I agree. Except for a couple of minor issues, specifically that one episode, the Vulcan episode. Otherwise, there was nothing that said, oh, I wish I wasn't watching it. Though it's definitely not a show that I would have ran to as saying, oh my God, it's must TV. In other words, it's not like Game of Thrones where the moment Sunday night comes on, I'm going to be rushing to the TV to watch. This isn't necessarily that type of show for me. But like you stated, it's definitely nothing that wanted me to turn it off either. It was a fun and enjoyable genre show. One thing that I thought was interesting about the final episode, I could see why the writers and therefore the showrunners felt that it was a good cliffhanger, because, you know, the spring is gone and whatever, and that's a kind of a big cliffhanger. But I think it fell a little flat because we were expecting a war of the gods, right? Or at least a union of all the gods to become, I guess, a platoon and getting ready for war. But also, I felt that since we don't have any real human characters in the show except for Shadow, who happens to be with Wednesday anyway the whole time, the loss of Spring doesn't really feel as tremendously big as I guess it looked on paper, because we have no perspective of any human characters really in the show. Yeah, so since we didn't have any human characters to follow, for example, a three-piece family, a mother, father, and maybe an eight-year-old in the middle of West Virginia or Ohio or something, throughout the eight episodes, that when Spring is destroyed, we don't have their perspective at how horrendous or horrific that is. So I think when they wrote it, the screenwriters and the showrunners wrote the destruction of Spring, let's have that as the finale of the season, it probably looked much cooler and horrific and scary and a cliffhanger on paper than it actually appeared on the screen, specifically for the fact that we didn't have any perspective of a character that the loss of Spring, or as life as we know it, is gone. So I think that's the reason why it may have fell a little flat, the cliffhanger or the last episode, because of that. We don't have characters that we're caring about that are really going to be desperately missing Spring.
Yeah, I don't know that there was clear what the large-scale impact, how far spread this was going to be. And for how long, right? What's the potential damage? I was kind of figuring out, okay, so she's taking Spring away from the world. I think having something in there to just emphasize to the audience exactly what that means might have helped. I wasn't expecting there to be the war with the gods. I was kind of expecting them to lead us closer to that path, and I guess they have. But I still, again, one more step felt like was needed for me. Others can disagree, and it's in the end, when the second season comes, people are going to be just going straight from episode 1.8 to 2.1, so it won't end up being that big a deal.
True, yeah. I mean, maybe they'll show like the apocalypse on season 1 I mean, season two, episode one, where people are going nuts, food, shelter, who knows what no spring causes. I mean, you mentioned that the reason people started praying to the Easter or the spring goddess before Christianity was specifically for the fact that by the end of winter, all the food is run out that they've been storing, that now they're just praying that, you know, all the winter goes away so they can actually start fishing and growing food again. So that obviously is going to be horrendous when you have no spring. But unless they show the apocalypse or maybe a character that can identify with us, the viewers, I don't think it's going to make that much of an impact, because we'll probably just want to see the gods again. I think if we had some extra characters that were human, that weren't gods, that didn't have anything to do with gods, that we were following in vignettes throughout the season and saw what it does to them, I think it would matter more. But because all we care about is, oh, we want to see the gods and the war with the gods, I don't know how it's gonna be portrayed next season, unless it's a generic view of it rather than anything more than that. Because again, we don't have any characters to really focus on that aren't part of the war between the gods. So yeah, I don't know. All right. So anything else you wanted to say, Mike?
No, I think I'm good.
All right, same here. I think I'm good as well. So we're going to take a hiatus now for probably about 10 months, because I figure the show, if it's eight episode season like last year, that means it would start probably the same time, even if it's 12. It's going to be, it won't be back probably for another 9 months at the earliest. So we'll be gone for 9 to 10 months anyway. Right before the season starts, assuming nothing happens and we don't want to give up podcasting, me and Mike will be back for a season prediction episode right before the season starts. So start looking for us 1 week before season two starts in 2018. Otherwise, until then, you can listen to us on You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, as well as Dark Discussions podcast. Both have their own individual feeds, but also everything, including American Gods, Searching for American Gods, are under the Dark Discussions feed as well, because the Dark Discussions feed is all-encompassing of all the podcasts that we do. But again, if you just like certain aspects of our discussions, you can follow us on our individual feeds as well. And those can be found everywhere, including darkdiscussions.com. Yes, and for all the feedback that you want to send us, darkdiscussions@aol.com, and we will read any feedback from Searching for American Gods, now that the podcast is in hiatus, on our Dark Discussions podcast episode. So you can still email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com and discuss American Gods, and we will continue to read those emails on our weekly Dark Discussions podcast episodes. All right. So, Mike, with all that stated, why don't you leave us out?
Once again, thank you so very much for following us on this journey through the first season of Searching for American Gods. We are always going to be happy to hear from you. And while we won't be broadcasting a new episode for 10 months or so, you can always send us feedback through darkdiscussions@aol.com or through the Facebook page. And until then, we hope to see you in one of our other podcasts, or maybe see you at one of the conventions that we do. Thank you again for listening. Peace out.